You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2017 on Monocle 24, the Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme...
Strong and stable leadership.
The strong and stable. When you have the strong and stable leadership that delivers a strong economy.
After 7 weeks of what might have been the weirdest general election in recent British history, polls closed a few minutes ago. With the first exit poll numbers due any second, we'll have a special extended discussion of the campaign and its possible consequences. And with frankly ill-deserved second billing...
Although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director... The administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
Former FBI Director James Comey testifies about his relationship with President Donald Trump and rather makes the most of it. We'll hear from Rick Perlstein on the strangest day in American politics since at least yesterday. That's coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. The row between Qatar and several other states in its immediate vicinity has escalated somewhat, with the beleaguered Persian Gulf promontory insisting that it would not be blackmailed into altering its foreign policy or words to that effect. Qatar Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani stressed that he favoured a diplomatic rather than military solution to resolve the crisis, which was either an attempt at reassurance or at thinly veiled menace. US forces operating in Syria have shot down a drone belonging to the Syrian military after it fired on US-led coalition forces near the Al-Tanf border crossing between Syria and Iraq. It is believed to be the first time that Syrian government forces have directly engaged the American-led militias operating in the country. No casualties were reported. North Korea has further deafened the long-suffering fish swimming its coastal waters, launching a salvo of what appear to have been anti-ship missiles. These are the latest in a recent sequence of missile launches of various sorts by the paranoid hermit kingdom. It is maddeningly unclear whether these latest ones contravene, as previous volleys certainly have, UN sanctions aimed at persuading Pyongyang to knock this sort of thing off. And actual grown adults have begun legal proceedings against a tennis player who wishes to make commercial use of the nickname he has acquired. Australian ball hitter Thanasi Kokkinakis has become known as Special K after the wholesome breakfast cereal, but the manufacturers of same, Kellogg's, have taken action to protect their trademark. Kokkinakis was recently bundled out of the French Open in the first round by, perhaps inevitably, Kei Nishikori.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election.
Mr. Speaker, we welcome the general election, but this is a Prime Minister who promised there wouldn't be one.
Can we agree to start with that the one thing that voters deserve in what you yourself have said is going to be a very, very important election is no sound bites.
Strong and stable leadership.
The strong and stable. When you have the strong and stable leadership that delivers a strong economy.
You cannot countenance a world in which we could all be destroyed by a nuclear war.
I see hospitals closing. I see staff that are at their wits' end because they can't give the care that they want to give.
There's boy jobs and girl jobs, you see.
Boys and girls jobs. Do you have boys and girls jobs in your own house? No.
What I am now doing is...
Have you changed your mind?
I think there are huge opportunities.
Have you changed your mind?
Jeremy, I know that you have used this tactic and you want...
I'm just trying to get an answer. Yes, that's all. Yes. You can say yes or no. I haven't changed my mind. Yes, I have changed my mind.
There are programmes on your station that I don't really agree with. You probably don't agree with them either. Isn't that what poop and debate and journalism is about?
No.
Sometimes listening to people that you don't agree with does you good.
Now, within the last few minutes, exit polls have been released, and so it now seems likely, we can say, that Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May has been returned with the increased majority and personal mandate she sought, or Theresa May has grievously miscalculated and wasted everyone's time to maintain the status quo, or Britain has descended into the chaos of a hung parliament, or Labour opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn has pulled off the most astonishing upset in British electoral history, and yes, I had to write the script before the numbers were released. I am joined for an extended discussion of today's vote and the campaign which preceded it by Carol Walker, political analyst and former BBC correspondent, Quentin Peel, associate fellow at Chatham House and former foreign editor of the Financial Times, and Sean Kemp, former special advisor to the Liberal Democrats. Well, we do have those exit poll numbers, and I think they may be best summed up by the expression, well. Carol, first of all, can you quite believe what we're looking at?
Astonishing if this exit poll turns out to be true, and it looks as if we could be in for a really exciting night, because clearly it's going to be very close indeed. If the exit poll is correct, it suggests that Theresa May, instead of winning that big majority which she set out to achieve at the beginning of this election, has actually lost 22 seats and has lost her overall majority. And I think that it will certainly put a very, very big question mark over her future. I'll add a quick rider to say that at the last general election, the exit poll underestimated the Conservative vote, and the Conservatives did slightly better than the exit poll suggested. But in the previous two elections, the exit poll was spot on. So it does look, on the basis of this, of course we haven't got any real results yet, but as though we could be heading for no overall majority. The Conservatives, the exit poll suggests, would get 314 seats, Labour 266. The SNP in Scotland losing 22 seats to go down to 34, and the Lib Dems gaining just a handful to go up to 14. What a suggestion, and what a night ahead.
So we'll see you all back here in 4 months then. Quentin, if this exit poll holds up, if this is the case, that if Theresa May has not increased her majority and indeed has lost the majority she had, she's done for, isn't she?
Well, she's really badly weakened, and I'm sure the knives will be out for her. I think whatever happens, she's going to be a weakened Prime Minister as a result of this campaign. It simply hasn't run for her as she expected. She's been a dull candidate, she's been repetitive, she's turned people off, and left the space for Jeremy Corbyn, the unelectable Jeremy Corbyn, to actually look quite good.
Well, we will come back to that shortly, because if, again, these results are correct, that's going to open up the question of whether this result is any credit is due to Jeremy Corbyn, and I guess it must be, he is the leader of the party, etc., or whether there is now an argument that a different Labour leader might actually have won this thing for them. Sean, beyond the sort of standard expressions of incredulousness, whatever the correct phrase is that you are internalising over there, what do you actually make of this?
I'm going to add the health warning that, as Carol said, the last exit poll underestimated the Tories.
Indeed.
In 1987, the exit poll said there would be a hung parliament and Margaret Thatcher won a majority of 102. And I know they have updated how they do them, but so that's the health warning. It is all we have to go on at the moment. I'm just trying to work out, if this was accurate, what you would end up having. I think Theresa May would end up having to resign. And I think the Conservatives would then end up having to sort of cobble together some short-term arrangement with the Ulster Unionists in Northern Ireland, see if that can get them over the line, and then I'll see you all in 6 months' time, is how it sort of feels to me. And there's something about this that feels a bit off to me. Not just that everyone was assuming a Victorian majority, because those things can be wrong.
Are you going to echo the sentiment of your former Liberal Democrat leader and promise to eat your hat if that
plays a right? I'm not going to eat my hat, because there's so much that's been unpredictable in politics and so on. And I don't think anyone's really felt they knew what was going on in the last few weeks, ever since the sort of the wheels came off the Conservative campaign. I, for example, struggle to believe that the SNP go from 50-odd seats to 34.
It would be almost extraordinary as their resurgence in 2015, wouldn't it?
You probably would have said to me exactly the same. Yeah, I would have struggled to believe 18 months ago they would have won all but two seats in Scotland. So there is maybe just going back to the norm. But so there is the health warning. If we have this situation, it's utterly undermines Theresa May, because she stood in Downing Street and she said, I need a big mandate to negotiate Brexit. I need you to tell me that you are confident, give me a big majority so I can go in there. And if this is accurate, the country's turned around and said, yeah, no thanks.
Carol, again, I think we need to stop. I think we can stop prefacing every utterance with the phrase, if this poll is accurate. I think we can assume the listeners will take that as read from here. What can we attribute this apparent minor meltdown, you could call it, of the Tory vote? Was it just that Theresa May turned out to be an extraordinarily flat campaigner, or are there other things going on?
I think we've certainly got the backdrop of extraordinary volatility. We have got an electorate which has simply cast away any ideas of loyalty to any particular party. And we have had a quite extraordinary election campaign. Let's not forget, of course, that campaign disrupted twice by two serious terror attacks in Manchester and in London. But it looks as though those were not the key events. It looks on the basis of this as though what we have seen here is Theresa May, who has basically failed to live up to the promise that she set out at the beginning of this election campaign. She set out to say, I'm going to offer strong and stable leadership. She then came up with a policy of paying for social care. There was a bit of a backlash, and she performed a very hasty U-turn and then told everyone that she hadn't performed a U-turn. She was very wooden. She did not turn up to one of the big election debates when Jeremy Corbyn did do so. And people have also pointed to, even most recently, when you come to the terror laws, she'd said, we're not going to look again at human rights legislation. She's now suggesting we might have to do that in the light of the terror attacks. Set against that, Jeremy Corbyn, who everyone said was going to be absolutely dreadful, has connected with people in the same way that he did during those Labour leadership contests. He has come over with a degree of authenticity, of honesty, as a man who has stuck to the principles which he has been espousing for the last 20, 30 years in Parliament, which until very recently were deemed way off to the left. For an international audience, this is a man, let's just remind people that Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's not afraid to call himself a socialist, who said, yeah, let's borrow hundreds of billions of pounds more to invest in the economy. Let's end austerity. It is an offer which says to the voters, you can have something different, you can have something new, and I'm going to change things for you. And I think, set against Theresa May's rather wooden bit more of the same, that appears to have resonated.
Quentin, electorates around the world have been clearly in somewhat odd moods for the last few years. looking at this particular election campaign, what cut through did you think as the issues that people decided on? Because for all that Theresa May said she wanted an increased mandate, not unreasonably, to negotiate Brexit, which is the greatest challenge, albeit self-inflicted, that Britain has faced in decades, it was remarkably under-discussed as a thing, Brexit, I thought. From where you're sitting, what actually shifted people? What were people thinking about when they cast their votes today?
I think the same thing that actually made them vote for Brexit in that referendum, which is that they're, excuse my English, thoroughly pissed off with the political class. And they have therefore, it looks as if, gone more for outsiders, people who are not part of that system. And the fact that Theresa May was so dramatically on message and so constantly just reflected actually the established political class, and Jeremy Corbyn, for all the fact that he hasn't changed any of his ideas for the last 40 years, nonetheless looked like much more of the outsider. And if they did get, and this is awfully key to whether this does hold true, if they got much more of the younger voters to turn out and vote, that must be an element in this. And that would be quite remarkable. I was looking at some figures for the most influential politicians on social media, and it was was really striking because the two at the top of the list were Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott, and Theresa May is way down the list. So if social media is really starting to affect things and is galvanising young people much more than it used to, that may be shifting things.
Sean, what did you make of Jeremy Corbyn's campaign? It was, I mean, clearly it was effective. To some extent, I guess, always a general election campaign was going to play to his strengths. He enjoys the campaigning side yeah. of politics. Did you get the impression, though, that he had smartened himself up, that the organisation had become more professional?
I think he was sort of better in his TV performances. There was less of the irritability that he used to show when he first became leader. But as Carol said, he's a good campaigner. People always seem to forget this. People who thought he'd be rubbish in the election clearly not watched him during the Labour leadership election, where he outmanoeuvred a load of people who saw themselves as being much smoother and slicker professional politicians. I think it's possible to overread what it means that Labour have done better than a lot of people expect in trying to enter some big social moment. I think in a sense it's quite easy. The Conservative campaign was dreadful. It was one that assumed that they were going to win by a landslide, and they therefore didn't have to bother with any kind of popular policy offerings. The big turning point of this whole election was the manifestos. The Labour manifesto was leaked, but it actually included loads of stuff, even if you could accuse it of not adding up and all the rest of it. It included loads of, we're going to do these popular things and make you feel better about yourself. The Conservative manifesto was basically a thin diet of gruel, and we're going to make you sell your house if you get Alzheimer's. And I think the Conservatives ran an entire campaign based on the idea that we are so far ahead, all we have to do is not do anything wrong, hide the Prime Minister away, and we'll sort of stumble over the line. The moment they had their Conservative manifesto kind of unravelled, the whole awe around Theresa May, that she was kind of almost like strong and silent, she was a stable one, and that all just sort of fell away. And then you basically had someone who was offering something to voters and someone who wasn't offering something to voters. And I think that played into Labour's hands. I mean, look, we're saying all this on the exit poll. The Conservatives still win. Like, they're still the largest party. We're putting in the context the expectations, but they're still the largest party. But
I just point out to you that it's only just a couple of days ago that Theresa May was out there in one of her final stump speeches, and she said, if I lose just six seats, I'll lose this election, and Jeremy Corbyn will be sitting down to negotiate with Europe. Well,
yeah, but that wasn't true. No. She knew full well that if she lost six seats, the DUP would stand up and go, don't worry, Theresa, we'll sort you out. I mean, that's just a lie.
But they did underestimate, the Conservatives did underestimate Jeremy Corbyn. They were so convinced that because Theresa May had wiped the floor with him in Question Time a few times in the Houses of Parliament, that because he was so far off on the left, people would never vote for him. They banked on that. And so they didn't, in their campaign, ever really address any of those Labour policies. There was a few people out there saying, well, the sums don't add up and so on. But apart from a few personal attacks on Jeremy Corbyn himself, they didn't really engage with that message that Labour was coming over with.
Even more, that the very fact that they went on and on and on about him made him look ever more of the outsider that actually a lot of people want to go for. They don't want the insiders anymore. So I think it actually positively boomeranged against them. And he then played one other thing very well. He never got personal in his criticism. So there was the Conservative Party slagging him off very personally. Even Theresa May, right after the terrorist incident in London Bridge, talking about people who tolerate extremism, totally clearly code for Jeremy Corbyn.
On that subject, though, Quentin, It would seem like a vast arsenal of live ammunition, Jeremy Corbyn's long history of dodgy associations with somewhat unsavoury characters from various theatres of asymmetrical warfare. Do you think that just didn't stick? Do people just not care? Or is it one of those things that people who really care about politics care about, but most people in the real world just go, eh?
I think it didn't really stick, actually. And I think that one other thing, I certainly felt on the immediate aftermath of that terrorist incident and Manchester, that the real feeling of people was, we don't want anybody to play politics with this. This is beyond politics. And therefore, anybody who tried to play politics actually looked stupid.
I'm going to disagree there. Okay. People always say they don't want you to play politics. And than they do react to people playing politics. And the idea that Labour didn't, and that's kind of for the birds. Jeremy Corbyn
said, they did.
Jeremy Corbyn said that Theresa May should resign and basically blamed her for the terror attack, saying it was the fault of her police cuts. So the idea, he did play personal.
Oh, no, no. Like, I'm saying they both played both smelt shitty.
But I don't think, people always say in focus groups, whatever, there is a reason why political parties who basically, for their very existence, rely on trying to understand what people want and what drives them to act in certain ways, follow certain tactics. And one of them is that as much as people say they don't like sort of negative campaigning and so on, it does have an impact. The weird thing with the Corbyn stuff was it sort of bounced off him. And what I've often wondered is that all the sort of you're a friend of the IRA and you've hung around with some dodgy people sort of stuff, I think they made him sound like he was the most terrifying man on earth. And the problem is that there's a lot of what Jeremy Corbyn said and done that I quite strongly disagree with. But he looks quite like an avuncular, bearded old lefty. He doesn't look like someone who you actually think...
And he is unfailingly polite and courteous. And he was able to point to the fact that ultimately Sinn Féin, at least, and senior figures in Sinn Féin who may or may not have had IRA connections were ultimately brought down to sit at the table and have talks, and that peace is the way to resolve things.
No particular thanks to him, it has to be said.
I should just say, though, that while we've been talking, there are a lot of senior Conservatives adopting the Paddy Ashdown approach and saying that they simply don't believe this exit poll and that they just simply don't believe those figures. Paddy Ashdown, of course, former Lib Dem leader, who said after the exit poll last time around that if it was correct, he'd eat his hat. Well, it was just about correct, and he never did. But I should say that on this news, the pound, I'm looking at a chart which shows the pound plummeting, literally, just on the suggestion of a hung parliament. Because, of course, if this exit poll is right, it is going to lead to a huge period of uncertainty. Where can anyone go with the Brexit negotiations?
Well, I don't think they can start the Brexit negotiations. They'll have to put them on hold.
I don't think they can. Can you do that? Is the clock not irretrievably running?
Well, I mean, look, we're going to have 3 weeks' notice while all of the European political class pick themselves up the floor in hysterical laughter. So we're probably get a bit of grace whilst they get their sides stitched back together.
But I mean, who leads the negotiations? You know, I mean,
I'll have a crack. How hard can it be?
Look, any other civilised country can take weeks or months to form a government. Why not us?
For exactly that reason, Quentin, no. For all the idea that this is a new instability, pound plummeting, etc., again, if the poll is correct, there is something stable about it, is it? This is a return to two-party politics.
Well, absolutely, it is back into the centre ground, except that they've done it by moving actually further out of the centre. So that's fascinating. I haven't calculated the figures, but there was a prediction that the two main parties would actually, for the first time in decades, get 80% of the poll between them, which is remarkable. Having said that, the figures still... If it were back to two-party politics, you'd have a majority. The figures don't add up, largely thanks to the SNP.
What I'd like to know, though, and I wonder whether Sean has got a little insight into this. So at the beginning of this campaign, Tim Farron, he's the Lib Dem leader, that's the third party, well, the fourth party, if you count the SNP north of the border in British politics, he said, no pacts, no deals, no coalition. This is, of course, the party that was in coalition with the Conservatives from 2010 until 2015. Under this scenario, does Tim Farron stick to that? Does Theresa May try to cling on by her fingernails by trying to see if she can persuade Tim Farron into a coalition?
There's no chance Lib Dems joining a full coalition. Like, even if these numbers are right and basically they say it's the only way of doing it, I think there's no chance of the Lib Dems risking the, on this basis, glorious 14 seats that they would have.
It's an improvement.
It is a great improvement, and more than I frankly was expecting, hence some of my cynicism.
A seat at the cabinet table for Tim Farron? Come on, surely he wouldn't be able to resist.
Of course, don't be daft. Of course he would resist. Because firstly, he would sign the part, like, in the same sense that the last coalition nearly sort of signed the Liberal Democrats' death warrant. To go into a full coalition, I think, would be nuts. And the only way that he could even sell a kind of what they call a confidence and supply arrangement, where you agree to vote through on certain things, but you don't go into a proper coalition, would be to basically get an assurance that there would be another a referendum on the result of the Brexit negotiations. I don't buy for a second.
That surely is a price that would be much too high.
The Conservative Party would just say, yes, see you in October. So I find it unlikely.
But on these figures, couldn't actually the Tories manage to get a majority with the Ulster Unionists?
I think that's the most likely scenario, is they cobble through the Ulster Unionists on these figures, and then they try and get through to sort of 6 months, a year down the line, and try and do something and have another election.
But most party leaders look at an election result, and there is this moment, isn't there, when party leaders decide, that's it, I've got to go. That's what David Cameron did after the EU referendum. That is what Ed Miliband did after the last election. He was the Labour leader who lost the election in 2015. And if Theresa May has gone to the country saying that she's calling the election in order to get a big, strong mandate for the Brexit negotiations, and she has thrown away the small majority that she's got and left her government in a weakened position, surely she could not, under those circumstances, remain as Prime Minister. Surely we would have to have, at the very least, a Conservative leadership contest.
What I wonder is, does Theresa May have in her head what the number that she needs, that she thinks she's actually it's fine to stay on? So clearly, I think if she doesn't win an overall majority, like, no chance. But if she wins a majority of 20, does she think that's good enough? Did she probably try and stay on about that? There is, in a sense, where in Theresa May's head is the number. I mean, still, I think as much as I frankly did burst out laughing and I saw the hung parliament prediction, what is the dream comedy result is actually that it basically ends up exactly the same as we were before this whole absurd election started. And we're almost back to square
one. If the margin of error is the same as it was in 2015, she could just sneak back to where she was beforehand. Because back in 2015, the exit poll gave the Conservatives 316, just two more than this current exit poll is suggesting. And David Cameron ended up with 331 seats. So if she got close to that, she could be just about back to where David Cameron was.
But she could
be just about back where she started.
But I think that would be a resigning one, though, because she did basically turn the test into the whole point, majority.
The whole point of this election was to garner this immense majority, which would give her this colossal authority. Quentin, to return to that thought about the idea of a return of two-party politics, is it possible that the reason for that return is the possibly, it's not quite counterintuitive now that I think, but it makes perfect sense, that the two parties on this particular occasion were giving people a choice? Say whatever else you would else about this election, I'd probably agree with you that it was unnecessary, annoying, depressing, etc., etc., etc. Nobody could complain that it was all the same, it was all much of a muchness, it didn't really matter who you voted for. There was actually a genuine choice here.
A very clear choice, and it looked as if it was squeezing the smaller parties, particularly the Lib Dems, quite seriously. UKIP melting down completely. The Tories largely grabbing the UKIP agenda, therefore, and that pulls them to the right. Corbyn, of course, had taken the Labour Party way over to the left. So you did have that very stark choice to make. And I think, I mean, I would have expected that to help the small parties. It didn't. It actually helped the big parties.
Sean, I'm not attempting to insult you by appointing you spokesman for the small parties here, but does that surprise you that as the two major parties pulled further apart, that there wasn't more room in the middle?
I don't think the two parties are apart as people make out. I think Jeremy Corbyn is a part of his personality. But actually, if you look at the Labour manifesto, it's basically Ed Miliband's manifesto with a little bit more nationalisation, in inverted commas. But it's been one of the great myths of this campaign that Jeremy Corbyn sounding on an incredibly left-wing manifesto. You look at it, it's pretty much what Ed Miliband was saying, a lot of it. And Ed Miliband himself has said he kind of wishes that had been his manifesto.
I think voters thought
Jeremy Corbyn was about to be basically a communist, and then they saw the manifesto, which got more coverage than any manifesto for an opposition party ever does, because some either idiot or genius, depending on what they were trying to achieve, leaked it. And I think they actually saw a lot of the policies and went, You know,
and it said lots of nice things, doesn't it? It said we're going to give students free tuition fees so that students don't have to pay for university tuition anymore. It said, oh, we're not going to take away your winter fuel allowance. It said, oh, well, only the very richest in society are going to pay a bit more, and 95% of you will be okay, and we're going to tax big business. And those are very superficially, at least, appealing messages, because it is something positive. It is saying you can get lots more. He did say he was going to put 250 billion quid into the economy to try to get infrastructure.
And meanwhile,
that all sounds great. Yes, you can say that the sums don't add up, but those were messages that voters, I think, were longing to hear.
I just want to ask somebody who's faster on the draw with arithmetic than I am, is there, and I'm just let's just take a meander out into the wider realms of fantasy here. Are there the numbers here for the actual coalition of chaos?
I think that ends on about 318.
Could Labour... Well, Labour 266 with 34 SNP gets...
No, it's 314 to 314 and no Ulster seats in there.
I think the problem is that the prospect of... getting a coalition of Labour, SNP and Lib Dems, I'm afraid that is really fantasy politics.
You would need others as well. You would have the one Green MP. Who else would you need?
I having sat through those days of negotiations over the coalition, which I'm sure Sean can also remember very well, back in 2010. And when you think what was required then to get two-party leaders who had at least a certain amount of common ground, to try to get that coalition together was quite an achievement. Yeah. I think the idea, firstly, of Labour going into coalition with the SNP, that would cause an enormous row. And I think that, as Sean says, the Lib Dems feel that they were so badly burned by their experience of coalition with the Conservatives that that is why Tim Farron at the beginning of this campaign had to rule out deals and pacts and coalitions. I should just tell you, though, that interesting, we were talking about Theresa May and senior Labour figures, Emily Thornberry, she's the shadow foreign secretary, is already saying that if the poll's right, May should resign. And George Osborne, he is the Conservative who was the former Chancellor.
George Osborne swigging heartily from a massive bottle of champagne right now.
Who was sacked by Theresa May and is now with a big smile on his face saying it's catastrophic.
Does anyone know where George Osborne's having his election night party? Because that's the one to be at.
He's on ITV.
I hesitate to say, but he's on ITN doing their election night.
Quentin, we should talk a bit about Jeremy Corbyn, who, if these numbers hold, clearly isn't quitting in a big hurry. Where does he take it from here, though? If these numbers stack up, and if we are in the realm of hung parliament, if the Conservatives descend into some sort of internecine warfare, do Labour just now hold the course they have established? And then hope that maybe 6-7 months from now, when we go round again, they can improve on this?
They are still a very deeply divided party. And Jeremy Corbyn is still a deeply unloved man to a lot of his fellow MPs. So I think this might
have changed that if he saved some of their jobs.
His critics have tried just about everything to get rid of him. If he has actually managed to get to the situation where he's gained 34 seats when people were at the beginning of this campaign predicting he could lose perhaps up to three figures, he will be in an unassailable position, however divided the Labour Party is, however much those who more centrist Labour MPs who hate him might dislike it, they will simply have to button their lips and accept it. And I would expect that Jeremy Corbyn will simply carry on doing what he has been doing. And when it gets to some of those key votes, some of those key decisions on, for example, on taxation, on Brexit, on the rights of EU nationals, he will be in an incredibly powerful position.
And what I'd say about Jeremy Corbyn is, I many, many flaws as a party lead, and it sounds absurd to say that if this turns out to be right, but what he has done is he has... it's broken the kind of consensus about how you kind of are meant to do politics. This increasingly sort of safe, don't take any risks type thing. When you saw him, when he did sort of equivalent of the TV debates, that May and Corbyn never faced up. When he was on TV and audiences were questioning him about why do you want to raise our taxes, he would basically say, look, you want a good health service, you've got to pay for it. Like, there wasn't quite that same. Now, he's been quite equivocal on some issues that he's found quite difficult, particularly on foreign policy, but a lot of that stuff, actually, I think a lot of people find it quite refreshing. That he was just actually, and I wonder if one of his long-term legacies might actually be, it reminds people you can actually campaign a bit on things you believe and not always have to be triangulating and so on. If you have a good retail offer to voters, they'll probably listen.
Well, just a final thought then, and I'll put this one to you, Quentin, and I do want it noted, I'm putting to it here that I had it already written down in the script. What are you most looking forward to about next year's election? So Quentin, predict the future for us. Go on.
Brexit negotiations abandoned. This won't, it just can't go ahead in this chaotic situation. We don't even know what we're asking for goodness sake. That's my hope.
Well, I think that we will see. If this exit poll is correct, I think it will be very difficult for Theresa May to stay on. There's already a lot of speculation about whether Amber Rudd might go for it if she keeps her seat. That has to be a big if, looking at these results here. Boris Johnson, he's always talked about, if the ball came loose at the back of the net, he'd be in there and to seize it. This could be his moment. You could potentially have another general election 6 months down the line with Boris Johnson back up against Jeremy Corbyn, and boy, what a great general election that would be.
But what a dreadful country to live in.
It's a 1974-esque situation. It would be, you'd have another election in 6 months' time.
Well, on that happy thought, date for your diaries there. Sean Kemp, Carol Walker, Quentin Peel, thank you all very much for joining us. Up next, against stiff competition, possibly the strangest day yet of the strangest US presidency ever.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world. Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. To the United States now, to the story which would have led our show pretty much any other day of the year. Just hours ago, television viewers across America and indeed the world saw and heard a former director of the FBI calling the President of the United States a liar. James Comey spoke for nearly 3 hours. This might, however, have been the key moment.
So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying that he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation, and learned again from the media that he was telling privately other parties that my firing had relieved great pressure on the Russia investigation. I was also confused by the initial explanation that was offered publicly that I was fired because of the decisions I had made during the election year. That didn't make sense to me for a whole bunch of reasons, including the time and all the water that had gone under the bridge since those hard decisions that had to be made. That didn't make any sense to me. And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
And for more on what we've just seen and heard, we're joined now, rather, by Sasha Eisenberg, our Washington correspondent. Sasha, that line, lies plain and simple, Comey will have been aware of the effect it was going to have. Is that a blow that's going to land on Trump?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we heard several times was him describe both Trump personally in the White House as having lied, and suggested that he had an understanding even before Trump was inaugurated that it was kind of in Trump's character to be dishonest or misleading, which was the reason that he took what he said was a sort of unprecedented step to take these detailed written notes after every one of the interactions that he had with Trump. You know, he talked about how when he first went to meet Trump Tower, at Trump Tower in early January to brief him on the existence of this dossier, the first thing he did was go down to his FBI car afterwards, take out a laptop and start writing down what had happened, because he basically said Trump was sort of personally predisposed to lie about things like this. And that became the sort of tone, which is why he's in a position to have a very credible record in what is, you know, basically a he said now about all these one-on-one interactions that he had with the president.
What have we had in the way of response from either Trump or Trump's camp?
So, you know, there's a sort of unusual response from the White House sort of structurally, which is that they send out Trump's personal attorney, who was recently retained to handle this matter, you know, not speaking from the White House, speaking separately, reading a statement that I think it's fair to say was filled with not only fairly embarrassing elemental typos, but some lies of their own and misdirection, and the claim that Comey perjured himself. The pushback has been, Comey used the word in that clip we just listened to that Trump had defamed him. That is not dying down. It has now become the sort of the default stance of Trump's personal attorney, of the Republican National Committee, which has taken charge of sort of overseeing the political response to this, is to treat Comey as a political opponent who they claim has lied now under oath, which is legally, especially somebody who's a career law enforcement officer or prosecutor, it is different to claim that somebody has lied in sort of the political conversation than it is to allege it that under oath before the Senate that they have committed perjury. But that was the core of Trump's response today.
Is that a sustainable strategy from Donald Trump, of all people, to stand up in front of the American public and saying, seriously, which one of us do you think is lying, the former director of the FBI or me?
No, it does not seem like a sustainable effort to build on public opinion. But everything we've seen Trump do in office, you know, even beyond the sort of contours of this investigation, has not been designed to expand, the coalition of support. The guy won with 46%. He's currently polling at 36% approval, and he seems to take consistently positions that by sort of playing on the existing polarization in American politics, harden some part of that 36% that is in his camp, but not to grow it. And so, you know, what we have seen sort of conservative media do, Republican politicians, is fall in line with the sort of adversarial politics we have and treat Comey the way that they would have treated Hillary Clinton or Chuck Schumer or whoever as a political opponent. The one thing that did seem to change today was the Republicans on this committee, on the Senate Intelligence Committee, all of whom served Trump's interests in the types of questions that they asked. There was a distinction that you could hear between them saying that Comey might have misunderstood Trump's intent when he asked him to lay off Mike Flynn or pull back from the investigation, or that maybe literally he didn't ask for something that would qualify legally as obstruction of justice. But none of them challenged Comey's credibility. And so what you hear from Trump and his lawyer now and people in the White House is a far more direct attack on Comey's credibility. I think that's because after a few hours this morning, it'll be very hard for Republican office holders to treat Comey as an untrustworthy narrator. I think the best thing that they can hope for is that you make the case that there was a kind of fog of war and that Trump was new to this and didn't really understand maybe how the protocol should have played out.
Well, we've seen Paul Ryan float that suggestion that maybe President Trump, having never worked in government, didn't know how these things worked and didn't know what was the done thing. But again, he's president of the United States. That's not really good enough, is it?
No, I mean, you know, I mean, look, there are a few different standards here. There's one is, how do reasonable people look at this? I think reasonable people say, yes, you are a successful businessman and now president of the United States. You should, you know, and you have tons of lawyers and people who have worked in government before around you. You should know that you don't meet privately with the FBI director to meddle in investigations that are centered around you and your campaign. Legally, showing that he did not have the intent to do this might be enough to steer clear of what, you know, the obstruction of justice statute under federal law. But fundamentally, that's not the issue, right? I mean, this either ends with impeachment or not impeachment. A president's not going to be subject to traditional criminal prosecution. And so the question is, at what point do Republicans in the House and Senate decide that they don't want to defend Donald Trump anymore and that it is more costly to them, likely regarding their reelection next year, to continue defending him as opposed to letting him go? And I'm not sure that leaving him out there as a hapless, you know, newcomer to the complicated world of dealing with the FBI is going to be a hill that they want to die on next year if he becomes so toxic to their reelection that they can't defend him.
Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's Washington correspondent, thank you for joining us. For more on this, I'm joined now by the journalist, writer and historian Rick Perlstein, author of the books The Invisible Bridge, Nixonland and Before the Storm, all of which are unreservedly recommended. Rick, first of all, I've been racking my own brains all day. You know more about this than most people. Is there any even vague precedent at all for what we watch today?
Well, I think the closest precedent from the Watergate hearings, which were also on television and, you know, kind of busted into prime time, just like now on all three networks, was the testimony of a fellow named John Dean, who was the White House counsel and very close to the conspiracy to pay off the White House burglars. And he basically decided he was going to save himself and drop the dime. And the TV ratings for that, apparently like two-thirds of all television sets in America were turned on to basically have him call the president a liar, which of course is exactly what Comey did today.
What leapt out at you from Comey's testimony? There was a lot of it. Obviously, that line, the lies, plain and simple one, is the one that's going to stick, I suspect. But what else struck you about what he had to say?
You know, I think it was the dramaturgy of it. I mean, we had seen his testimony. We kind of know most of the evidence. There's lots of kind of little suggestive things that might point to things in the future. But the very fact that the Trump White House clearly made a big investment in painting him as a rogue, you know, as someone who was political, as someone who was not trustworthy. They even put television commercials on the air, a super PAC did, basically saying that here's this crazy liar. And when people turned on their TV and saw this extremely calm fellow, you know, someone who uses words like lordy, you know, the kind of stereotype of the straight and narrow FBI agent that you just like Sasha said, you can't really maintain with any kind of credibility the notion that this guy is a creep or out to get someone.
Donald Trump has, and I'm just checking his Twitter feed now, not yet tweeted, which is either demonstrating uncharacteristic restraint or that somebody has hidden his telephone. But based of what we have now come to understand of Donald Trump and his temperament, how do we expect him to react?
Well, he seemed to have outsourced the live tweeting to a Donald Trump Jr. whose Twitter feed was absolutely unhinged and really didn't help the case at all. But I mean, I don't think that we can expect any sort of discipline or sedulousness from Donald Trump because we never can, and he won't be able to help himself. And he'll probably attack the integrity of the messenger, which, again, I don't think will work given what people saw on their TV screens.
There was another key phrase, which was the discussion of what Comey says Trump said to him about the FBI investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And this was, as Comey reported, at President Trump saying, I hope you can let this go. Now, Comey made the comparison or invocation himself of Henry II and Thomas A. Becket, the popular myth being that the priest was murdered because people overheard Henry II saying, will somebody rid me of this turbulent priest, and took his his rhetorical exclamation literally. Does Comey's interpretation of that seem more reasonable? If you hear somebody who is occupying the Oval Office saying, "I hope you can do something," somebody in Comey's position, a senior bureaucrat, is going to hear that as an instruction, aren't they?
Right. I mean, I think that the literary reference suggests a mindset on the part of Trump that he wants him gone. And that's very important when it comes to an obstruction of justice investigation. You can't say it was an accident. You know, he has to have wanted to do it. And the other thing is, he said that, but he also said that he considered it an order. So that's, you know, we don't have to put too fine a point in it. He thinks he was ordered by the president to do something that the president should not have ordered him to do. So that's pretty open and shut. Jeff Toobin, the very shrewd New Yorker legal commentator and former prosecutor, says, you know, we have an obstruction of justice case here. We don't have to get too complicated about it.
So do we think it was deliberate deviousness of Trump, whether sort of conscious or instinctive, to phrase it like that, to give himself a bit of wiggle room? Because, you know, there's a difference between, there's a certain ambiguity there, I guess, if you see it from his point of view, saying, I hope you can let this go. He hasn't called Comey in and said, James, I want you to obstruct some justice for me.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we in America, and I'm sure you in Britain, have a fondness for mafia movies. And we have The Godfather, where, you know, we see one of the family's hitmen say the family has a lot of buffers. And then, of course, we're all familiar with The Sopranos. And it really sounds to us, to our ears, very much like the way a mafioso would sound. So I don't think that's particularly exculpatory either. Maybe in a legal sense, but not in a political sense.
The hearings Comey was appearing in front of course, are not in to Donald Trump as such. They are the investigations into still alleged, not yet proven links between the Trump campaign and Russia. What is actually more important here? Is a kind of showdown, which is a richly dramatically appealing prospect between a dismissed FBI director and a serving president, going to overshadow what may be a bigger problem here, which is Russian interference in America's democratic process?
Well, that was really, really striking, right? Because that was one of the most galvanizing moments in the hearing, in which, you know, Comey looked the American people in the eye and said, you know, it's not a Republican thing, it's a Democratic thing, it's an American thing. You know, they're coming after the integrity of our nation. And I think the most revealing, if not legally, culturally, part of the hearing was when he was asked, did Donald Trump ever express to you a concern about how your investigations are going into Russia interfering with our elections? And he said, no, never, which just shows that Donald Trump is only out for himself. You know, he's not basically, as his oath of office requires him to do, taking care to basically enforce the laws of the United States. He doesn't care. He just cares about getting himself off. So once again, the dramaturgy of it makes it, Trump look more narrow and selfish and petty and criminal than he had looked yesterday.
Are we getting any nearer, do you think, the bottom of the question of Russian interference in American elections? And I guess that question itself presupposes that there is a bottom to it.
Right. Well, I suspect we are. And people who watched might have noticed the exigency where at several points in the hearing, they said, well, we can't talk about this in open session. So basically, the Senate goes behind closed doors and talks about the classified stuff. And that's where the meat is. And there was lots of very suggestive movements in the hearings. For example, when he said we had to go into executive session to talk about why Jeff Sessions had, why he was concerned about Jeff Sessions' recusal, which basically seems to implicate the attorney general in this scandal too. But, you know, we won't know until Mueller comes forth with his report. Unfortunately, when you deal with issues of matters of national security, you can't sort of talk about them in public. But the NSA has apparently been involved in the largest canvas of evidence in their history. And, you know, those guys, as we know from the Bush administration, you know, see everything and know everything. So I think we're heading towards an end game here.
Well, when you say an end game, and it does seem an extraordinary thing to be discussing when we are 140 days into Donald Trump's presidency, for all that it seems like 140 years. What would be the steps that would indicate that that process was definitively underway? Would that be a certain fracturing of resolve among senior Republicans? Would you start to see some suggestion that maybe Fox News was beginning to turn its guns around? What should we be looking for?
No, it's precisely that. It's the action of senior Republicans and Republican backbenchers as well, because as Sasha pointed out, and as people have been hearing again and again, impeachment is a political process. You need the votes. I mean, Nixon lost basically his confidence in the American people once a Republican started saying they weren't going to vote to save him. So now that his, you know, approval ratings really are going down day by day, and we have an election coming up in 2018, many, many Republicans are going to have to look themselves in the mirror and decide which way they're going to go in this. And that's fast approaching, that eventuality.
Well, you talk about those approval ratings, and they are historically abysmal for a president at this stage of their first term. But there is always talk about an irreducible rump. Nobody's really sure where it is, but there is a wedge of Trump voters, 25-28%, who whatever he did and whatever he said are going to back him. Or are they, is the question. Is there any sense at all that they are beginning to crack?
There is a sense that they are beginning to crack. There's a lot of suggestive kind of noise in the statistical soundings, his approval ratings, his strong approval ratings going down, you know, only by 5 points, but it's early days. The fact that white working class voters, only 51% support him compared to very much higher, you know, after the election. And, you know, quite frankly, the fact that you cannot win an election, a presidential election in the United States or a Senate election, without getting a massive amount of your own party, because the country is so polarized. So people say, oh, 71% of Republicans still like Donald Trump. Well, you really do need 85% of Republicans coming out and voting for you in order to win an election. So these are all things that are played out in the margins, and we're beginning to see movement there.
It is, of course, well, always impossible to know precisely what's going on in the White House, and even more difficult to know precisely what's going on in Donald Trump's head. But we came into this discussion citing the precedent of Nixon, the president, which, of course, you've written about extensively. Now, if you look back on those last sleepless, rambling, paranoid, whiskey-sodden months of Nixon's presidency, how potentially dangerous or difficult is anybody when they're cornered in that position, but never mind when it's somebody as volatile and self-centered as Donald Trump?
Wow, that's a very shrewd question. You might be familiar with not quite confirmed reports from back in 1974 that Alexander Haig basically told the military leaders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that if they wanted to do anything, launch any attack or anything, or take any order from the president involving military involvement, go through him first. In other words, break the constitutional chain of command, because they were so worried that he might take extraordinary action, even military action, to save his presidency. So this is, again, the guy, you know, in charge of the nuclear codes. He doesn't really seem to be a particularly stable person. So that's a very worrisome thing.
So just finally then, and with all due acknowledgement that asking people to predict anything where Donald Trump concerned is a dreadful imposition to make, how do you see the next few weeks playing out?
Well, I don't think the next few weeks necessarily will show a lot of drama, and that's kind of unfortunate for the story itself. You know, it might have been a little early for Comey to testify, but now things kind of go into Mueller's hands, and he's, you know, promised to do things kind of quietly and slowly and deliberately. So a lot of this will not be unfolding in public in any kind of dramatic way for the next few weeks, you know, unless, you know, who knows what kind of bombshell will drop.
Rick Perlstein, pleasure as always. Thanks for joining us. Before that, our man in Washington, Sasha Eisenberg. That is it for today's edition of The Monocle Daily. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Jolene Goffin and Fiametta Chisana. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now, at which point we might have some idea who will be the next government of the United Kingdom. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow, 2200. I'll be your host for that. Again, we might by then have some idea who will be the next government of the United Kingdom. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.